this was a people conscious that everything they did was affected by their relationship with God. And so the law covered everything. Now the law had to change with circumstances. First, when God gave them the law, they were in a wilderness area and they were semi-nomads, living 6 months at a time and a place. Then they entered the promised land, and when they did, they were basically a farming people. So the customs of farmers are slightly different, and the law had to be changed, and there's reflections of both of this. Then by the time of Jesus, they weren't just farmers anymore. There was some business, city life going on, and the law had to adapt to this. The law, jumping ahead to the history, when they were exiled to Babylon, the temple was destroyed for the very first time. They had no temple for sacrifice, and they're in the midst of a strange people. And the only thing that makes them look different is the law. The fact that they are listening to what the Lord said. And they tried to do this. The law, a technical word for it, is the Torah. And there's two groups. The law can be written, and that's what is in the Bible. That's what they mean by the written law, okay? The law could also be oral, passed on. Not just what is in the Bible, but the way what is in the Bible has been applied to changing circumstances by later teachers. Those who accept only what is in the Bible at the time of Jesus are called the Sadducees. Those who say that what our ancestors, what the great teachers have added, applying the law to changing times, are Pharisees. They're not evil words. Every time I use that word, I feel, ugh. The Pharisees at the time of Jesus were the Jewish people who tried to live the law the best. They were the best living people. That's why we miss a phrase. Jesus says, hey, you know, unless your holiness is greater than that of the Pharisees, you're not going to be able to enter the kingdom. Well, any good old Catholic, any good old Christian can say, boy, my holiness better be better than that group that nailed the Lord to the cross. But that isn't what Jesus is saying. The shock value of this is, unless you're holier than the saints. Because the Pharisees were the holiest people of their time. The same thing is true when Jesus says, it will be easier to take a camel and pass it through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to go to heaven. Last time we shared how they didn't have a belief in heaven and hell and God could only reward people on this earth. And one of the ways he rewarded people was by giving them material blessings. So who therefore are the holiest people? The richest. The fact that you're rich shows that God is blessing you. Why is God is blessing you? Because you're good. So who are the saints? The rich. And when Jesus says, listen, you can take a camel and put it through a needle before you can take a rich person, a saint, and make him part of the kingship. What Jesus is saying for both of these is the same. It's impossible for man. But you don't have to worry about it because God's doing it free anyway. So you don't have, you know, it's impossible for man and God's doing it as a gift and that can help you experience it. Okay, so they had the law written and then later oral. The Sadducees, those who take just what is in the Bible. And in the Bible, you don't find resurrection. So the Sadducees don't believe in a resurrection. By the time of Jesus, there were strong oral rules. And a lot of this had become a lot of development in thought. The Pharisees do believe in resurrection. That's differences in the groups. The Pharisees, unfortunately, became part of a group that took the law. And rather than use it as a way to say thanks to God for the gift he was given, they began to turn it around and make it a way that they earned what they were, they thought they were earning what they were getting from God. And this is a tendency that is ever in man. To take law, try to live it, and feel that when we do, God now owes us something. And that was a very sick tendency that occurred. So the law was originally a way of showing that you are special because of what God's doing and living this specialness that is yours. But rather than constantly staying this way, they then took it a list, sort of a menu, to become holy. And it can't work that way. But that's how the Pharisees did it. They tried to win their own holiness. And in that sense, it became a little bit unfortunate. One other series of thoughts, and then we'll have a little short break. If you read the Old Testament and in the New Testament, you'll eventually run in to clean and unclean. And I'd just like to point this out so that you won't be confused. Those words have nothing to do with moral and immoral. Absolutely nothing at all. We think they do, and because of this, we get our thoughts really loused up. Clean and unclean have nothing to do with being good and evil in God's sight. Clean and unclean simply deal with your dealing with society. They are basic guides that are written into the faith, if you want to give it in one big rule, to keep disease from spreading before modern medicine. They deal, you can be unclean because there is unclean food. We'll just take the best example, the pig. It spoils so fast in a hot climate, and people can get food poisoning so very, very easily from pork undercooked. There's other reasons for it, but that's one big one, okay? The other areas that deal with clean and unclean, just to show that there's nothing to do, sex. Any sexual relations renders a person unclean. Having sex with your wife makes you unclean. And you're no more or less unclean than if you rape someone. As far as being unclean, it occurs from the sexual relations. The other areas, and I'll try to explain them all together, illness and death. Now, illness, especially skin, most especially, almost kind of exclusively, but blood, definitely. Any touching of blood makes a person unclean. We know so much about medicine, and this kind of makes it hard for us to go back and see how simple this is, how logical. They noticed certain things spread disease. Touching a dead body did. You touch somebody that's got the plague, that died from the plague, you go bury him, you know what's going to happen? Chances are pretty good that a week to 10 days from now they'll be burying you, and the group that buries you will be burying in 7 to 10 days. So what's one of the rules to keep diseases isolated? People who touch a dead body are unclean and have to do certain things to try to become clean. Skin diseases, leprosy was, they just had no power over. How do you protect all of us from my leprosy? I become unclean, which means I can't socialize with you. All of this affects varying ways that we're going to socialize. Any touch of blood, there's always the touch of contamination. And this, I believe, is probably one of the reasons why it affects all sexual relations. Because of a woman bleeding during her period, the identification of blood with sex, and then a person has to become clean. Now, you don't become clean by saying you're sorry. There's no sorrow to become clean at all. You wash yourself in varying degrees depending upon what's happened. For some of the serious things, you stay isolated from everybody for 7 days. You wash yourself, you stay isolated, you wash your clothes sometimes, and then, if nothing's happened, you wash yourself again, and now you come back to society. That's clean and unclean. It's primitive hygiene. But it's written into the law. One of the sad things is we've identified both of these. We have made unclean the same as immoral when there is nothing at all together with them. A woman is unclean for 40 days after giving birth because of all the blood, the weakness, everything else. She isn't just strong enough. She can pick up any kind of a disease. Lots of things I could think of quickly. So protect her and protect everybody else. Keep them apart. She doesn't come up into the court of women in the temple. Keep her away for a while for her good and everybody else's. But that doesn't mean there's anything bad about where she's at. It means she's quarantined. But she can be saintly. Now we have, by identifying them, passed over some sick thoughts on sex. That's one of the reasons that we can use, I believe, with our very weird views that sex is what it is, that it isn't a beautiful gift from God. Because we've identified unclean with immoral. It isn't. No connection at all. One scholar is making an excellent case that unclean means you are supra holy. You're contaminated with God, and before you come back to the regular world, you better decontaminate yourself because the world can't handle it. Blood is a way of touching God because only God is responsible for life. Death is something awesome with the presence of life. If you touch a dead body, somehow you're relating yourself to the mystery of life in the mystery of dying, and only God is over this. And sex does lead to birth, so God here again is also connected. So unclean might be even changed beside the quarantine. There's two ways. First you get quarantined, and then also you are too holy and you better wash yourself before you come down and just touch the regular world, because the world doesn't deserve yet to be touched that way. Now that would be a fabulous understanding for those of us who have difficulty with having picked up the wrong feelings about sex from religion, from society, from our parents, but not understanding what the Bible itself would share often about this. Okay, we'll take a 5-minute break now. A long time ago, we left the Jewish people at Mount Sinai. They got there about halfway through the last session, and we've been commenting in a general way about their faith since then. We left the Israelites there, to use the technical term. After God covenanted with them, made them his people, they didn't immediately get into the promised land. We're told that for 40 years they stay in the wilderness. That would be, for 40 years they would be, didn't have a map that would show the whole thing, would be like down there. They're not in the promised land at all. They're out of Egypt, which would be the blackboard. They've come through the Red Sea, and they're way down here where the curtains are, and down at the bottom in a wilderness area, wandering around. Here God feeds them. Here God guides them. God feeds them with manna. He leads them to water. And he does guide them. They're tested in several ways, and they usually fail. They grumble. They grumble about God. If you didn't understand this, you'd miss the temptations of Jesus as reported in the Gospel of Matthew. And Luke. Jesus goes out to a wilderness area where he fasts for 40 days. And there he is tested by the forces of evil, as Israel during its 40 years were tempted and tested. You can change this bread, these stones into bread. Jesus faces three temptations that Israel faced during the wilderness, and Israel flunked all three. And Moses told them off in the book of Deuteronomy. Jesus will take the three of the answers of Moses, and tell the devil off. So he is the new Israel. And in him, the forces of evil will never be victorious. So, as it actually happens in his report, this period in the wilderness is a period of trial and a period of failure very often. But as later recalled by the prophets, it changes. This was the time when it was just Israel and God. And Isaiah and the later prophets view this as Israel's honeymoon with God. And there was nobody else around. No pagans with their gods to compete. And so Israel loves God alone and has to take God's hand. And the prophets see this as an ideal period and picture the end almost as their return to the wilderness where God is going to be able to give them all of his love. So they stay there for 40 years. At the end of these 40 years, they kind of come up in a roundabout way. I'll just identify how the map is briefly. Here's the Dead Sea. Here's the Sea of Galilee. The Jordan River starts up in the mountain snows here, flows down, flows into the Sea of Galilee, continues to flow down and flows down into the Dead Sea. It drops unbelievably fast. The Dead Sea, I think, is 700 feet below sea level. Anyhow, it's way below sea level. And the water flows in and just evaporates there. There's no place to flow out since you're down that low. And that's how it becomes so salty. There's no life here. All of this area here would have been the promised land where the tribes will settle. They come up on this side and they cross over the Jordan. After the 40 years wandering, which means that it's a fresh group. It's not the group that leaves Egypt. 40 years means a generation. It's not an exact time. It isn't the group that leads Egypt, pretty much, that enters the group that enters the promised land. Incidentally, the symbolism of this is the new promised land is God's kingship. When Jesus starts guiding us as the new Moses, we're not immediately going to be completely in the kingship of God. There's a period of time. God will keep unfolding more and more within us. Moses isn't the person who guides them. I ought to show the connections because when we get to Jesus, there won't be that much opportunity. Jesus is pictured as a new Moses. First, as a child, many of us know this story, because the Pharaoh had threatened the life of every young Hebrew, Moses had to be saved from the Pharaoh. How terrible God's people, Israel, have become is shown from the fact that at the birth of Jesus, he must be protected not from a pagan Pharaoh, but from King Herod, who is one of the kings over God's people. And Jesus is protected by being carried down to pagan Egypt. So he undergoes a similar threat that Moses does. Jesus, I'll go into the Gospel of Matthew because this is probably the biggest theme. It's a theme of Matthew. Connecting Israel and Moses together. Israel came out of Egypt, passed through the water, went into the wilderness, and then at Mount Sinai became God's people. Coming into the life of Jesus, there is a record that he's in Egypt. And then the very really next event occurs about Jesus himself. He is in the Jordan River being baptized by John. So from Egypt as a child, even though there's a passage of time, but the events go to water, through water. He then goes into the wilderness for 40 days, and shortly after that, he goes up on the mountain and gives the Sermon on the Mount, which is the new law. From the mountain, Moses brought down the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, telling God's people how to relate, how to respond to the Spirit he was given. Matthew is telling us that Jesus is the new Moses, the new and greater Moses, passing through water. And incidentally, there's a new creation going because when Jesus is in the water, the Spirit of God, the Ruah, is again hovering over the water. So Jesus is starting a new way of living. He's the successful Israel. He comes up on the mountain. When he gives the law, he's the new Moses. Right after this, Matthew has a collection of 10 miracles that he gives that Jesus works. Almost one right after another. There's just two little breaks. And before this, to free God's people, Moses worked the 10 great acts, the 10 plagues. To free God's people from physical slavery. Matthew is showing Jesus working 10 great wonders, healing God's people to free them from spiritual slavery. So Jesus is the new Moses. And there's a parallel shown, the new and greater Moses. You have heard it said in the Sermon on the Mount, he shows himself to be greater. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That was in the law of Moses. But I say to you, I don't need any other authority. So Jesus is the new and greater Moses as he's present. He is the law. How are you going to relate to God? In Jesus. How does God relate to you? In Jesus. If we just understand that it's simple and it's great. Okay, but the old Moses wasn't great, complete. Nobody almost in the whole Old Testament comes off perfect. They're all real people. Moses angers God. He's allowed to see the promised land. He doesn't actually bring God's people into the promised land. A man named Joshua does. Joshua, if you put it in Greek, and took the Greek into the Latin and took the Latin into the English, comes out Jesus. Jesus is off the Greek of Joshua, which is Hebrew. So the same name, exactly the same name. The name of Jesus was Joshua. The name means God is saving. It is Joshua who has the privilege to lead God's people into the promised land. And when they enter the promised land, the first great place they get to, Joshua fit the battle of Jericho, if you remember the song. In Mark, Luke, and Matthew, Jesus spends the whole first part of everything he does in up here in the north called Galilee. He's not really in Judea, which at that time would be symbolic of the promised land. In Matthew has five booklets. Four of them occur in Galilee. Mark, you're probably, I don't know how many chapters it would be, a long, long time up here. Luke has his gospel divided in three. A third in Galilee, a third on the journey, and then they start coming to Judea. And when they get to Judea, the very first place mentioned is Jericho. They're leaving Jericho. We were just told, then Jesus leaves Jericho. You're not even told that he got there. The only important thing is that the new Joshua is bringing God's people again through Jericho on their way to the heavenly Jerusalem, which is a way of symbolizing God's kingship, God's presence. So Jesus, the new Joshua, is leading us to the heavenly Jerusalem. So they come into the promised land under Joshua, going back to the historical part. And there are people there, the Philistines. And you get the impression that they conquer them all, but they don't. They pretty much have success. There's a mountain chain running about where my hand is. And they have success in the mountain chain. But along the Mediterranean, where the land kind of slopes down into valleys, if you read carefully enough, they don't go. And that's where the Philistines stay. They can't really kick the Philistines off the plains and the valleys because the Philistines have something that the Israelites don't. They have steel. And therefore their weapons are superior. And in a pitched battle, they usually clobber the Israelites. So they just conquer the mountains. I would like to just make a little comment on one point of their entry. Other things that are neat that to know the term the Ark and the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is a box, pretty much. Not a very big box. Inside it were kept the Ten Commandments until the exile. Afterwards, they renewed sort of a symbol of the Ark, but they never refound the commandments. This was their sacred sign that God was present to them. Besides this, they had the tent of the meeting. Now, it isn't where Israel met. It was the tent where God met Israel. And the ark was kept there. Another word in English off the root of the Greek word that we use for tenting is tabernacle. God tents with his people. He doesn't have a permanent location. He's not the God of Jerusalem. He's the God that freely has picked the people, and he keeps his freedom. He isn't tied down to a place, as almost every other God in people's minds at this time was. This God is free. The real God is free. He's not tied down to the temple in Jerusalem. He tents, and his people follow him. And the ark is could be seen almost as a footstool of his presence. Well, for about 200 years, well, one other thing that I had to mention, we had the ark. I wanted you to just, in case you didn't know the terms, to be familiar with them. When they enter, they are told to wage the holy war by what we read in the Bible. And this is where I hope you were able to hear or to be at the class we had on how the Bible was written. God takes people where they are and deals with them. There's something called the ban, like when they conquer a town, they're supposed to kill everybody. All the men, definitely. And then in some towns, even the women. And Saul, we're told, loses God's favor because he doesn't slaughter everybody. And this seems just unbelievably cruel to us. We're not really getting what God told people. He's touching people. He's bringing them along from where they were. And they're reading a lot of their own ideas in it. What God is trying to get this people to understand is that he doesn't want them to be contaminated by anything they touch. His people are holy. And they can be contaminated by the thought of their neighbors. They have something to give their neighbors, not to take from their neighbors. What they take from their neighbors can only harm them. Now that would be as far as any communication from the part of God dealing with the holy war. The other part of it just flows from the ideas of the time. And it isn't from God. But since this was the idea of their time, they read this as being something that God himself does want them to do. And as far also, finally, as we could tell, it's much more theology than fact. They never really destroyed any of these towns this way. Nobody would give up so much possessions. Nobody would surrender so many slaves. They wanted to hang on to their slaves, so they do hang on to them. What they're doing is teaching a theology that God's people kind of had to be kept clean. For a period of 200 years, there is no official ruler. There's 10 or 11 tribes united by the fact that they're gods. And when an emergency comes, God sends someone to show his righteousness, to bring God's judgment upon whoever is threatening his people. They therefore are God's judges. They're not judges the way we picture it, where before this would be Gideon, Samson, these are the great leaders. Deborah, there's a woman in here, the great leaders that God provides to save his people. They don't function as judge hearing cases and saying innocent or guilty. They bring God's judgment on his enemies. They therefore function as the judge in God's place to save his people. For 200 years, there are people, when an emergency comes, God's Spirit provides a leader. God's Spirit provides the help that they need at that moment. Later, Saul is anointed king. Saul loses his kingship, and then later it's David. David rules for 40 years, and then his son Solomon rules, and Solomon rules a long time. With Solomon, with the death of Solomon, there's a split, and it's a very important split. It's a split between the 10 tribes of the north, and they are known as Israel from that time on, and the two tribes of the south. And they're known as Judah. They just don't call Benjamin by name at all. After the son of Solomon Therefore, the descendant of David continues as king in Judah. No descendant of David functions as king of Israel. They have a whole new line. Therefore, now all of the traditions dealing with God are passed on in the north and in the south. In the north, they remember things that are unfavorable to the king. In the south, they remember things that are favorable to the king. And if you read the Bible carefully, every so often you can become a little schizophrenic. Because you see God opposing Israel wanting a king. And you see God picking a king. And you wonder, well, now what side was God on? Did he want a king or didn't he? Why didn't he make up his mind? Two different traditions have been carried on. There also are two traditions about the temple. After the split, Jerusalem is in the south. And the temple is there. Well, the north isn't going to say you've got to go down to the temple. That's the only place you can offer any kind of worship. The north keeps traditions where you can sacrifice in several places. The south just keeps traditions around the temple. That's a little bit of background. This split becomes very important. So God finally, or the people, ask for a ruler, and the king is anointed. And the king represents the whole people. From this time on, there is sort of a tension, and there always is, and there is today among God's people, between those people that God sets up to serve the needs of his people, the appointed rulers, and the charismatic. The word charismatic means charism is a free gift. Those people that God kind of blesses with a special gift, and this gift rises, enables them to rise above everybody else and lead the people through some emergency. And there's always a tension in the church between both of these. Right today, there should, and it's a healthy tension if we're open to it. One of the problems with some churches is they try to go just by charismatic rulers, and they're missing the fact that God has set kings over his people and does have give Peter a very special place, and there's no doubt about it if you read the New Testament carefully. So there are appointed leaders, but then God does bless people with charisms, with his gifts. There always are judges facing emergencies, and in the Catholic Church there's ever so often a temptation for the appointed rulers to think they've got it all and not to be open to God inspiring other people to help guide the church. So there's this tension in the Bible itself. There were the judges, and then did or did not God want a king? One tradition says yes, preserved in the north. Another tradition, says yes, preserved in the south. Another tradition says no, preserved in the north. Well, that's good. Does all leadership come from appointed leaders? Yes and no. Does all leadership come from charismatic leaders? Yes and no. That ought to keep us open to both of them. All leadership comes from God. All leadership comes from Jesus, who is King of Kings and who has the whole, everything that God has to offer. So Saul's appointed. If you read the Bible carefully, Saul unfortunately went a little bit insane at the end of his life. He had fits of insanity. David then comes. David does finally defeat the Philistines and conquers the whole land. He is able to bring a unity together between north and south. For the first time, they're all united, and it takes them a while. He's king over the south alone for 7 years, and then 33 years over the whole kit and caboodle. 7 years of being king before the north will come in and say, yeah, we want you. There was a tension already. So the whole land's united. To help this happen, David picks a neutral city that has never been conquered and conquers it, Jerusalem, and he brings the ark there. And it becomes not a city of the south, not a city of the north, it becomes the king's city, a symbol of his own personal, David's city. And by bringing the ark there, he makes it the center of worship, and everything is centered on Jerusalem. David sets up a good nation. Solomon rules okay, and then the split comes. with the split, you have these two nations. Sometimes they get along and sometimes they wage war. There's a period they both have their own king. In the year, giving you some time dates, Abraham probably lived around the year 1800, 1500 to 1800 years before Jesus. About 1250 years before Jesus, Moses leads the people out of the promised land. For 200 years, they are ruled by judges, so the easiest one to remember always is David. David lives roughly 1,000 years before Jesus. The kingdoms divide. Then, 722 years before Jesus, out around where the door is, the nation of Assyria becomes very important, and it conquers almost everybody. It comes in and it completely conquers the northern tribes. It moves many of them out and it brings other people in and settles them there, and the northern kingdom never exists again. Its traditions about God were carried into the south and preserved and will become important. To this date, not one book of the Bible is written in its final form. From 1800, when God starts touching Abraham, we're now at the year 722, and there isn't one word of the Bible. Yeah, we're at the first ones. The prophet Amos starts speaking. We'll get to the prophets in a moment. For about another, Assyria comes, and it's getting ready to conquer Judah, and they surround Jerusalem, and all of a sudden their army goes back. And nobody knows definitely why. There could have been a plague and there could have been a revolt. Historians find both reasons for both. Could have been a plague and a civil war at home causing the army to leave. But Judah was all set to get clobbered, and Isaiah the prophet assured the king, hey, it ain't going to happen, the king of Judah. And all of a sudden the Assyrians pick up their army and march off. That's in 722. In the year 586, Judah is conquered, and that's a very important event now. The northern tribes are lost forever. The southern tribe is conquered about 140 years later, and they're marched across the desert, not wilderness, across the desert to Babylon, and they spend 40 years in Babylon. The temple's destroyed. They have then a new exodus. Babylon itself is defeated, and a Persian king, Cyrus, who is very liberal in religion, allows the Jews to return. At first, just a very few do. They go back to Jerusalem, and they build a very small temple, and slowly more and more trickle in. They almost never have their own independent nation again. There's a very brief period, right about 100 years before Jesus, when for a short while there is and a completely independent Jewish state, but it's not that absolutely important. So from the return, from about 540 some on, they're under different nations. Now, on how the Bible itself is written, a lot of these traditions with God dealing with people have been passed on in the north, passed on in the south, passed on by priests, passed on in many different ways. Nothing had to be really recorded, though. The very first things, when God's people started drifting, he wanted to warn them, and so he spoke to them, and he sent them prophets. A prophet is not one who predicts. A prophet is one who speaks God's word. We've shared that, and it can't be shared too often. A prophet is one who will say, my people, I say to you. And he really is speaking for God. It's God speaking through him. He's not saying, listen, Israel, the Lord is going to tell you you're going to get clobbered. When a prophet speaks, he speaks. If he's speaking prophetically, he'll say, my people, I say to you, you're going to feel the hand of your enemy because you're forgetting my love. For years, The Jewish people were waiting for something called the Day of the Lord. That would be when God intervened, and boy, he was going to clobber their enemies. The first prophet comes up and he warns the northern nation. Listen, his name is Amos. He understands that God is just and that God isn't going to protect Israel when Israel has drifted from the law, when widows are starving and orphans are being cheated, that God isn't going to give his power to protect this people. He's going to let this people be protected by their own weakness, and they're going to be defeated. God isn't punishing them. They're punishing themselves. But Amos is saying, listen, you've been looking for the great day of the Lord. God is just. That's the great notion that Amos said. And because God is so just, his justice is for you as well as for everybody else. And right after Amos is the first of the prophets whose writings we have, comes another one, Hosea. And Hosea is one of the most fabulous people in the Bible. He says, yes, God is just, but God is also merciful. We don't know whether he's telling us a story or whether he really lived it. He married a prostitute. She left him to go back and function as a prostitute, and he takes her back. And he compares this to God dealing with his people. God marries Israel, and she had prostituted herself before. After God marries her, she prostitutes herself again, going off and sleeping with the gods of the Canaanites and the Philistines. Yes, God is just, and he will allow her to be punished by the Canaanites and the Philistines. But God is also merciful, and he'll wed himself back to her again. Hosea couldn't really work out how he would do this. Right after him came Isaiah, the next great prophet in time. And Isaiah said, the way God will do this is there will always be a remnant of his people that he will protect, where he will keep his spirit alive. And they're ever going to know what he's doing. And they're going to help keep the whole chain. After Isaiah comes a whole sweep of other prophets, God constantly warning his people. So the Bible starts being written. Then after they return from exile, now they start really putting the law down, because when they were in Babylon, the law became so important. So they write the law. Now that they don't have their own nation, their history is important. And they write their history, not to tell us about the history. All of their history is written to show that when they're open to God, they prosper. When they turn from God, they suffer because of their own weakness. And the history is written to show this. And it'll be changed to show this. But it isn't lying, because the person writing it knows that, look, you can't be open to God and not be blessed. You can't allow, when you're open, you're accepting God's blessings into your life. And they've got to come in, and you'll just experience it. So there's, the books then are all written from about 522 down to about 100 years before Jesus. The great periods of history are recorded during this time. When the last of the books, well, we have first the prophets. That's what I was sharing with you. Then after that, what they call the history and the law. They'll refer to it as the law. God's dealing with his people. Then they did build a temple, so you have the books of worship, and the book of Psalms are written. And then finally, they've got to teach their kids. And to teach their kids, you get the wisdom book. Books of Proverbs. A wise son heeds what his father's teaching. A fool is a person who scorns rebuke. I can always quote that one, because my homeroom teacher read it to us for 3 years in a row in high school when I went through. A wise son heeds his father's instructions. A fool scorns rebuke. And they're simply collections of proverbs, all guided by the Spirit of Jesus in its own way. So all these books, about the last group of them to be recorded, are the wisdom books. And basically, until the year 150 years before Jesus, nothing is written. Abraham was first called in 1850. So for 1,000 years, God's dealing with man is remembered but not written. In final form, at least. The final books start being written about 750 years before Jesus, and the Old Testament, from the first book that is written to the last, spans at least 600 years. It's written over a long period of time. But that doesn't end it. Between the writing of the last book and the time of Jesus, Jewish thought continues. And it's very important to know that, because Jesus lives in this continuing thought. And the ideas of the time of Jesus are different in some significant ways from the ideas of the time of the last book of the Bible. And that would be probably the last thing we'll share. Just take a moment for that tape to run out.